Those are students and faculty out demanding a fair contract from Western Illinois University, one of the many public colleges in Illinois struggling with funding, leadership, and enrollment. We'll talk about the reason for these challenges and some possible solutions. Plus, with all the conversations about gun control, last week the Effingham County Board declared that their county was a, quote, sanctuary for gun owners. Here's your state's attorney, Brian Kibler, on Fox News.
We're making it known to the Illinois General Assembly that if they keep on this path of stripping away Second Amendment rights, there's going to be blowback from the people of Southern Illinois.
At a time when other cities are trying to ban assault-style weapons, we're taking a look at how different areas across the state are taking matters into their own hands when it comes to gun laws. And you know the Big Mac, but what about the Mighty Angus or the McSpicy? McDonald's new headquarters restaurant has food and drinks from some of their locations all around the world. It's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Over the past few months, we've seen renewed calls for gun control. Last week, many students across the U.S. walked out of their high schools to protest gun violence. The whole debate is also playing out on the state and local government levels. Here in Illinois, there have been rallies both for and against gun control in Springfield these past few weeks. And yesterday, a bill that would have added more requirements for gun dealer licensing failed after the Senate chose not to attempt an override of Governor Rauner's veto. Meanwhile, local communities have taken matter into their own hands. Last week, the Effingham County Board declared their county to be a, quote, sanctuary for gun owners. We're going to be talking to municipalities on two sides of this issue. Effingham County, where they've declared themselves, as I said, the sanctuary county. Later on, we're going to be speaking with the mayor of Highland Park on Chicago's North Shore, which enacted a weapons assault ban in the case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And we're going to be asking, is any of all of this legal? Let's start with Brian Kibler, the state's attorney for Effingham. It's a little more than an hour south of Champaign. Hi, Brian. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Good morning, Nyla. It's a pleasure to be with you.
What prompted the decision to have Effingham County declared a sanctuary county for gun owners?
Well, our county board likes to have symbolic votes on a lot of things every year. And one of the things that was really bothering certain county board members after talking to their different constituents were the numerous different gun proposals that were in the General Assembly, such as the one to make it illegal to for anyone under 21 to buy a 50 caliber rifle. Also, the current proposals to ban any the sale of any firearms that has more than 10 capacity ammunition. So there was a lot of concern. So we thought, well, let's put a resolution together. And there's kind of a proposal or a template out of Iroquois County that was similar to that. So we thought, well, we'll start with that. And then we just kind of tried to add a little bit more to it, a little bit more to make it more of a symbolic. So we just came up with this idea of let's reappropriate the term sanctuary county for our own purposes. And that's what we did. And it started out just as a little bit of a symbolic thing. We never really thought it would get into the stratosphere of debate like it has. It's been a really interesting situation. So we put together this symbolic ordinance, and the next thing you know, everyone was talking about it. So that's kind of how it all came about.
And just to be clear, as you said, it's symbolic. What exactly does it say?
Well, essentially it says any of these new these legislative acts that are in the General Assembly that we feel are unconstitutional under the Second Amendment, if they ever become enacted, that essentially Effingham County is not going to enforce these illegal, unconstitutional laws that come out of the General Assembly. Since none of them have come out of the General Assembly right now, it really has no effect. It has no force. It's just symbolic. There's no law that we're not really enforcing on the state level because those laws haven't passed. It was just our way to kind of do a symbolic protest. So that's why we use the word sanctuary county. Any of these laws that pass the General Assembly that restrict and pinned on our Second Amendment rights, we're just going to call Effingham County a sanctuary county, and we're not going to enforce these unconstitutional laws. So since it's all speculative and these laws haven't passed, it's mostly symbolic right now.
Mm-hmm. And Brian, to the point of you said you wanted to reappropriate the word sanctuary, obviously, to state the obvious, that's something we've heard in terms of immigration. Why did you all want to use that word in terms of protecting gun owners' rights?
Well, we figure that if other counties with different, political leanings could say, okay, our place is going to be a sanctuary county, well, we're not going to enforce certain laws or help the federal government enforce certain provisions of federal immigration law. Well, why can't we do it down here in Southern Illinois? So essentially, that's where it came about, and it was just kind of a symbolic thing that we put in this resolution that passed the county board. I think that's obviously the word that really got this into the stratosphere of public debate, because we took a word that's become kind of sacrosanct to certain people, and we used it for our own purposes. So I think that's what really happened is the word, using the word sanctuary county, obviously makes it a little more provocative, and that's how it all, I guess, became a big to-do. So it was just a little symbolic thing we wanted to do, and the next thing it's statewide. It became nationwide. So it's been an interesting kind of a couple weeks for us here in Effingham County.
And as you said, Brian, the county board approved this measure 8-1. This is, as you said, in the stratosphere of public debate. I just wanted to ask you one last question about that whole public debate and public discourse side of this.
Sure.
Guns are a really contentious issue. There's lots of divides between places that are for gun control. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking to the other side of the state and to a community that has taken an opposite action of you.
Oh, right.
And
And
then to Southern.
that was part of the protest, was the thing in Deerfield where they were outlawing essentially AR-15s with $1,000 a day fine. That was another impetus for us to kind of do this little protest resolution.
And so, right, to that end, I wanted to ask if you have any ideas on how to bridge the gap between communities like yours and other communities that completely disagree. Do you think we need to?
I think that there were some really things I think both sides can agree to. I really think the mental health provisions and the different laws we can change to make sure that people with mental health issues don't have access to firearms. There are provisions in there that I think we can agree to, but I think what's happened is it's become so contentious, and no one trusts each other, unfortunately, that everyone's just gone to their own corners and haven't talked. But I really do think that that there can be some agreement on how we're going to handle mental health issues and gun ownership. I know that's been talked about a lot at the national level. I think that might be an area of common sense solution
It sounds like
between
common
both
ground,
sides.
yeah, as well.
That's the one common ground, and I think one of the unfortunate parts is with just how the debate's going is we're not looking for that one thing of common ground that I think everyone can agree on. Instead, we're going to our own little corners. And for instance, let's one the opposite side of us is saying, well, let's just ban the sale of any rifles that have more than 10 rounds or can shoot more than 10 round magazines. So then when it becomes a fear that they're going to start outlawing guns, then obviously the my side then kind of retreats to its corner. But I think after that Parkland incident, there was, I think, an opportunity there that was lost to kind of seek that common ground on the mental health components of how we go about taking guns from people who have severe mental health, the whole legislative process, the whole due process issues that are tied into that. That was a piece of, I think, common ground that I think has been lost. So that is one thing I think you can bridge a gap on, but to be honest, with the current state of the situation, I just don't know if there's much other common ground besides that.
That's Brian Kibler. He's state's attorney with Effingham County in Southern Illinois. Brian, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
No, Nyla, it was my pleasure, and it's a beautiful day, so hopefully you'll get out to enjoy some of this.
After I'm off the air, I plan to. Thank you for that. Let's go to Highland Park, to the opposite end of the state. Another Illinois community, as we're saying, reacted in the opposite way a few years ago in a case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Mayor Nancy Roetering is with us from the city of Highland Park. Mayor Roetering, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Good morning, Nyla. Thank you.
So this was this happened a couple of years ago, back in 2013. Brian Kibler was mentioning another suburb, Deerfield. You're in Highland Park. Can you give us a little bit of the thinking behind what went into you all wanting to enact some gun control legislation in your neighborhood?
Sure. In 2013, the Illinois General Assembly passed its Concealed Carry Act, and within that law, there was a very temporary provision for home rule municipalities, if they so chose, to ban assault weapons and large capacity magazines. And it was 6 months after Sandy Hook, and my council and I concluded that this was the right move to make, that we needed to seize this opportunity, that it was going away rapidly if we didn't take action. And so we did pass an assault weapons ban and large capacity magazine ban. At the same time, Deerfield passed a law within that provision, but only focused on safe storage and defined what an assault weapon was, with a plan later to amend the law if the state didn't take action. And so a few weeks ago, they concluded that, you know, here we are 5 years hence, the state still hasn't taken action on assault weapons and large capacity magazines. So they chose at that point to amend that law that they had passed in 2013 to contain a ban on assault weapons.
And Mayor Roetering, is this something it sounds like you would like to see throughout the state, not just in your town?
Well, it's interesting. In the Seventh Circuit's opinion on our case that we ended up having, Friedman versus City of Highland Park, the writing judge, Judge Easterbrook, noted that it was something that's celebrated in our nation, federalism at the local level, essentially allowing cities to make decisions concerning their public safety. And so when we did hear back from the U.S. Supreme Court that that Seventh Circuit opinion would stand, I contacted my state senator, Julie Morrison, and said, let's change this Concealed Carry Act temporary timeline and open up this opportunity, at least for this conversation across Illinois cities. They don't have to ban these weapons, but if they choose to, it is their constitutional right, as noted by the Seventh Circuit. So we've been working on legislation since then, and I was in Springfield a few weeks ago testifying in support of Senate Bill 2314, which is now awaiting scheduling of its third reading on the Senate floor.
And I wonder what kind of response you have gotten from your community, especially over the past couple of weeks. As we were just hearing Brian Kibler say, those folks in this town and in this county in southern Illinois wanted to be very clear about passing something symbolically because of this. It was a response to what's been happening. What kind of response are you getting?
Well, it's interesting. In Highland Park, there's a lot of pride that we took action when it was feasible, when it was unique. And since Parkland, I've received a number of requests from cities literally across Illinois, not just up north, asking for copies of our ordinance. We've had this conversation that there's still state preemption, but to keep an eye on Senate Bill 2314, that opportunity may soon come their way, in which case they can choose to or choose not to ban assault weapons.
Mayor Roetering, I wanted to just ask you one question that I also asked Brian, and he talked about people being in different corners on this issue. Do you see a way to bridge the gap in our politics when it comes to gun laws? Do you feel a need to bridge the gap?
Absolutely. It's all about having a balance and recognizing that there are steps that can be taken together in the name of public safety. And so universal background checks certainly need to be at the top of that list. I think banning bump stocks is something that the majority of people will agree to across both sides of the aisle. Straw purchasers and this issue with so many of these mass shootings occurring with guns that have been obtained legally. Let's unpack how those guns were obtained legally and what within those laws isn't meeting the needs of maintaining the public's safety. And again, if you look at the data, we know that large capacity magazines and assault weapons really obviously increase the lethality, the amounts of mortality occurring in these crimes, and there needs to be a balance. So I think there is opportunity for us to come together. Certainly, even Justice Scalia in the Heller case said that there is not an unlimited right, that rights under the Second Amendment are not unlimited, that there do need to be some constraints around what these weapons are able to do and how people are able to get their hands on them.
Mayor, let me just ask you one last question about this in terms of the legal aspect of this. You've focused on laws. I'm thinking in particular of the shooting, the unfortunate shooting that happened this weekend in Nashville. A person who was accused of this crime of killing four people with an AR-15 had his FOID card taken away in Illinois. So the laws, you know, Illinois has really tough laws and they worked in that case. Do you think that the answer to preventing mass shootings is going to come from more laws?
I do, frankly. And people may not like the answer, but my feeling is that these are weapons of war. These were weapons that were created to really enhance the carnage. There are ways that, and plenty of opportunities for people to defend themselves, defend their families, defend their homes, that don't involve the opportunity for others to get their hands on these weapons and create mass carnage and grief. When you think about Las Vegas, those weapons were obtained legally. That's a problem. When you think about, I believe, San Bernardino, those weapons were obtained legally. That's a problem. So let's step back. Let's look at what our end goal is here. To quote Dick Durbin, if you need an assault weapon to hunt, maybe you should take up fishing. These are really strong, intense, uncommon weapons that have no place on our streets and in our communities.
That's the mayor of the city of Highland Park, Mancy Rotering, with us. Mayor Rotering, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Nyla.
We have to take a break, but coming up, we're going to end this conversation with constitutional law professor Eugene Kontorovich. He's going to talk to us all about the legality of all of these municipalities. We heard a little bit of Mayor Rotering's perspective on that. He's going to be joining us after the break. As always, your questions or comments are welcome. You can tweet them to 21STShow. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about the issue of local communities and guns, how they've taken matters into their own hands, a symbolic measure passed by Effingham County Board in Southern Illinois last week, declaring their county to be a, quote, sanctuary for guns. We just heard from the other side of the state in Highland Park and Mayor Nancy Rotering and the efforts that she is continuing to do to have assault weapons banned and other legislation she's working at the state level. I wanted to welcome Eugene Kontorovich to the conversation now. He's a constitutional law professor at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law. He's actually joining us on the line from Israel, where he teaches in the summer at Northwestern's joint program with Tel Aviv University. Professor Kontorovich, welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
As we've just heard, gun legislation can and is taking very different forms. Legally, what's the basis, Mayor Rotering got to some of this, for municipalities being able to enact their own laws about this?
So the authority of municipalities to enact their own legislation basically stems from the state, which allows municipalities to incorporate and gives them authority to regulate their internal policing to some matter. So it's really up to the state of Illinois how much authority over these kind of matters local communities have. Illinois has chosen to allow municipalities to take such measures, but ultimately such authority is controlled by the U.S. Constitution. And the Second Amendment is a federal constitutional provision which neither Illinois nor municipalities can exceed. So the extent to which municipalities can do this as opposed to the state is a purely internal matter, but really the outer limit of how much they can regulate is a matter for the U.S. Constitution.
And how does that work, that interplay between the Constitution and interpretation for local laws? Any local law, it sounds like, obviously has to fit with the Second Amendment, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Whether it's a federal or a state or a municipal measure, the constitutional test is basically the same.
And that takes in the constitutional test being, does this fit in with the current interpretations of the Second Amendment?
With the second, it's as with any other constitutional right, be it free speech or anything else, whether it fits in with the Constitution as interpreted, of course, by the Supreme Court.
And are you seeing,
And the Supreme Court has said that, which I think a lot of municipalities in Illinois are still sort of in denial about, has said that the Second Amendment is a real constitutional right. And some people are unhappy with that because they think it's not a good or valuable constitutional right. But just like speech can be used in harmful ways, but nonetheless there is a right to free speech, there is a constitutional right, just like there's a right to speech and a right to bail and a right to have your possessions not searched by the government, there is a right to have and carry weapons for the purpose of self-defense.
And then I guess the question is, when it comes down to interpretation of the Second Amendment, what kind of weapons? Because that's really the conversation that people are having now when they're talking about gun control. From a legal standpoint, I wonder what the argument is there.
Right. So the question is what kind and where. And we shouldn't succumb to the tyranny of labels. An assault weapon is not a magic name or a magic formula. It's a term that has been purposefully applied to a very broad class of weapons to make them sound very unreasonable and dangerous. But there, you know, there's no scientific definition of what constitutes an assault weapon. And when I think the layman hears the term assault weapon, they're thinking of a machine gun or some kind of automatic rifle that's capable of shooting multiple rounds or shooting continuously with a single trigger pull. But the rifles we're talking about here are semi-automatic. That is to say, you have to pull the trigger each time you want to shoot, just like with a revolver. And high capacity, you know, one man's high capacity is another man's low capacity. But the Highland Park measure, I believe, treats high capacity as more than 10 rounds, which is a very non-obvious definition. And I don't think any military unit is going to be conducting an actual infantry assault with weapons that are not automatic and can only hold 10 rounds. I think a useful way to think about it is pretend it's not the Second Amendment, pretend it's not gun rights, if one is skeptical of gun rights. Pretend it's another constitutional right that one thinks is, one agrees with from a policy perspective, say speech by journalists or comedians or abortion. There's similar questions with abortion rights. What kind of abortion procedures? How far into the abortion? And generally, the court has found that measures that make it substantially more difficult to exercise personal discretion in these matters are an undue burden. And I think in this case, it's quite obvious that the municipality is passing this law to make it more difficult for people to have the kind of guns that they would want to have. It is designed to burden. And so I think that's the standard that one needs to consider. And certainly constitutional scrutiny is not avoided by calling something an assault weapon.
That's Eugene Kontorovich. He is a constitutional law professor at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law. Professor Kontorovich, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take it.
For the past few years now, the headlines about Illinois' public universities haven't been great. There's been funding problems coupled with a steady decline in enrollment that's led to fewer jobs, changes in leadership, and in some cases, strikes on campus. Today, representatives from the Illinois Board of Higher Education went before the House Higher Education Appropriations Committee to seek a $254 million increase in funding. I'm joined now by its executive director, Al Bowman, from the State House. Hi, Al. Welcome to the 21st.
Good to be here.
Al, you just left the floor of the House. Can you share with us what you're seeking from the General Assembly?
Sure. We understand the fiscal challenges that the state is facing, but we believe firmly that investment in higher education operations is extremely important. To put this into context, if you look at state funding for higher education operations since 2002. Today's number is about half of what it was back in 2002. And I retired from the presidency at Illinois State University back in 2013. And the state support for operations today is $30 million less than when I started that job in 2003.
That's really, I think when people put that context, I think lots of people are listening thinking, how can universities be operating then?
Well, and what has happened is that institutions have raised tuition and fee rates in order to backfill for the decline in state support. And of course, that's pushed tuition rates higher than universities would have liked. One of the frustrations with what we're dealing with is that the amount of money that Illinois spends on higher education is actually very large. The total budget request for this next fiscal year is $3.4 billion. Unfortunately, $1.7 billion of that total will be directed at pension debt. And of that $1.7 billion that goes to pension debt, 75% is for old pension liabilities. So we are spending more on pensions than we are on university operations. In fact, nearly $600 million a year more on pensions than on university operations.
So given that context, asking for a $254 million increase, are you optimistic that that will happen?
Reasonably optimistic. A quarter of $1 billion is a lot of money. And given the backlog of unpaid bills, given the fact that this year's budget is still out of balance, it is an upward climb. But I'm encouraged by the fact that there is a conversation underway about higher education that I haven't seen in a long, long time. And I think it's been triggered by concerns about the out-migration of Illinois residents to other states to attend college. And I think that's gotten the attention of the General Assembly and certainly the public. And from my point of view, that's good. We need to think clearly and have an open conversation about what we're doing for universities. Are we making the appropriate investments that will incentivize our young people to remain in the state? And I think this is a positive. Long term, as a state, we have to gradually improve our support for university operations, or we will continue to see these declines.
That's Al Bowman, as he said, former president of Illinois State University, current executive director of the Illinois Board of Higher Education. Al, thank you for being with us and taking the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
What are we seeing with our public institutions? To Al's point, I wanted to bring a few more folks into this conversation. Stephanie Furtado is a labor relations expert at the University of Illinois. She's in the School of Labor and Employment Relations here with me at our studios in Urbana. Hi, Stephanie. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you for having me.
Stephanie, as you're listening to Al discuss funding and talking about the pension liabilities was, I think, an education point perhaps for people, a reminder for others. What do you think people don't understand about how higher education is funded throughout the state of Illinois?
So I think what people don't understand is that it's a mix of funding, right? So there's the public funding that comes from the state, there's tuition, and then there's, you know, research funds. And so universities like the University of Illinois that has, you know, a sizable endowment and solid research funds was able to weather the storm that we just had, you know, this 10-month budget impasse that we had. Overall enrollment actually increased by 4%, and they were able to sort of hold the line on tuition. But that's not been the case for many of the other universities that are more reliant on public funding. And for example, for some of those universities, the average was 6.7% increase in tuition. Because if you have to balance the budget somehow, right? And if public funding is decreasing, these universities and higher education are becoming more and more reliant on tuition dollars. But even universities like the University of Illinois system, which was able to weather the storm, had to basically not fill 400 staff positions during the impact. So this is a real impact on real people's jobs and ultimately the quality of public education.
I should say, in the interest of full disclosure, I should point out that along with Stephanie, because our station is licensed to the University of Illinois, I am technically a University of Illinois employee and a state employee. As we're talking about these other universities, I wanted to bring a few more folks into the conversation. Jennifer Fuller, she's been covering Southern Illinois University for WSIU in Carbondale. Emily Boyer is also with us from Macomb, Tri-States Public Radio, where she's been covering the issue at Western Illinois University. Emily, Jennifer, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to be here.
Jennifer, let's start with you. We've seen SIU in the headlines a lot in the past week or two, in particular in regards to these different campuses. What can you tell us about SIU's situation right now in terms of enrollment, retention, and the budget?
Well, as your listeners are probably aware, Southern Illinois University is one of two systems. The University of Illinois is the other system in the state. So there are two campuses, one in Carbondale, one in Edwardsville. Southern Illinois University Carbondale has been struggling for more than a decade now with declining enrollment and really trying to figure out what to do to turn those numbers around. And when you couple that with the budget crisis, it's something that really came to a head at the Board of Trustees meeting this month, where there was a resolution that would have directed $5 million of the state funding that comes to SIU as a system to SIU Edwardsville. What the folks from Edwardsville are saying is that this is leveling the playing field. Traditionally, 60% of state funding has gone to the Carbondale campus because it has been, until just recently, larger. It's also a research institution. SIU Edwardsville got 40% of the funding there, and that has gotten a little bit out of whack. Right now it's at about, I believe, a 64% to 36% ratio, and so they were trying to even that playing field. That resolution didn't pass, though. It failed on a 4-3 vote.
And I know this has been a bitter debate. We actually have some audio from a professor at SIU Edwardsville, Ganesh Archul, speaking about this reallocation of funds.
To precondition a reallocation decision upon the completion of the restructuring is highly disingenuous, to say the least. But somehow the distinctions between SIUC and SIUE surpass comparison for the purpose of a concrete budget allocation decision. With restraint, I only note that we at SIUE are also productive in research and creative activities, nurturing our growing numbers of undergraduate and graduate students despite our greater teaching load and lower salaries and resources.
That's SIU Edwardsville CS Professor Ganesh Archul talking about this. Jennifer, you can hear sort of the emotion there. I imagine this has become a very contentious issue. What do the enrollment numbers look like between Edwardsville and the Carbondale campus?
Well, what was once a gap is quickly closing, and there is some talk that for the first time in the fall of 2018, SIU Edwardsville will have a higher enrollment than SIU Carbondale. I believe last fall it was less than 1,000 students that separated the population of the two schools, and it's a highly emotional issue. Very territorial at times in terms of who deserves what amount of money. The Board of Trustees, particularly those that voted against the reallocation proposal, were not saying no, they said, because they disagreed with giving the money to Edwardsville. What they'd like to see is a consultant come in and really take a look at how to distribute the money fairly, whether it's based on enrollment, whether it's based on whether, you know, it's a research institution or not, how much it costs really to educate each one of those students. And that's something that the administration says it's taking on immediately to get that consultation in progress and perhaps change the formula going forward.
We need to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Jennifer Fuller talking about SIU, Emily Boyer from the campus of Western Illinois University. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning into the 21st. Right now, we're talking about the state of higher education with a focus in particular on SIU. We've been hearing about the divisions there as they're talking about reallocation of funding across two of their campuses with Jennifer Fuller. She's the Associate Director for News and Public Affairs at WSIU Public Broadcasting in Carbondale. On the line from Macomb and Tri-States Public Radio is Emily Boyer. She's the Morning Edition host and reporter. Emily, can I ask you, as we've been hearing about SIU, I wanted to ask you about Western. You've been covering Western for some time. What can you tell us about Western's enrollment and budget situation at the moment?
Student enrollment at Western has been steadily decreasing for about the last decade. The budget impasse did intensify that situation, though, and last spring we saw enrollment fall below 10,000 for the first time. It was down another 9% this spring compared to last year, so we're hovering around 8,600 students at this point, and the administration has since written into its strategic plan that it wants to prioritize recruitment and try to get that number back up to 10,000 and hopefully stabilize it there.
Wow, that's a lot, 9%. That's seems like a big drop to me. I wanted to ask you about what we've also seen recently from faculty. There was a recent vote, 65% of faculty voting, they had no confidence in the administration of the university as a whole. Can you tell us a little bit about what the significance of that vote is?
Yes, and I would add that the percentages are based off of the number of faculty who voted, and turnout was around 64%. I only say that because it was a pretty contentious issue here locally, with the administration being very quick to dismiss the results of the vote, saying it had failed because it wasn't an overall majority of the faculty.
That's a good clarification. Thank you for that.
But we see these votes of no confidence at different colleges, but what's unique about this one at Western is the fact that it's not in anyone in particular. You know, usually you'll see a vote of no confidence at a president, but here at Western, they passed a vote of no confidence in the entire administration. So it's not just faculty are dissatisfied because of the falling student enrollment or the budget impasse. It's more that they are upset about how leadership is responding to it, and the vote shows they're unhappy with the direction of the university as a whole, given that the administration typically leads the institution towards its future.
And there's also been a strike announcement, Emily. Can you tell us, what's the status of that? More than 600 union members, it's faculty and staff, correct?
That's the University Professionals of Illinois. It's the local 4100 chapter. It represents professors, academic support personnel, also advisors on the Macomb and Quad Cities campuses. Their members voted last week to authorize a strike. It gives the leadership the ability to call for one. The union has filed its intent to strike notice with the labor board for the state, meaning that the first day they could call for a strike would be Monday, this Monday, April 30th. UPI has been negotiating with the administration for 18 months over a new contract for its employees. With the threat, though, of that potential strike, this week's mediation sessions reportedly have gone very well, and both sides have issued a joint statement saying they are close to reaching a tentative agreement, and they're back in the negotiating room today, in fact.
Oh, well, that's good news. As we're talking about this, Jennifer, I wanted to ask you, that was the situation at Western. We know that here in Urbana, U of I graduate students recently went on strike, but I wanted to ask you about news yesterday that SIU is asking department chairs to work as free volunteers?
Not exactly. What it is, and there's still some confusion over what exactly will happen, the university says that it's embarking on a pilot program partnering with the Alumni Association to try to recruit alumni with terminal degrees or high-level degrees that can do some of the things on campus that are necessary. Some things are not unusual. To have a community listener as a part of, for example, a thesis committee or a dissertation committee, guest lecturers and things like that. There are some concerns, though, among faculty and others that you're asking people to do the jobs that faculty do for free. It's a 0% appointment for those volunteers. And so there's still some confusion over what exactly is going on. The Faculty Association, the union that represents tenured and tenure-track faculty, is still taking a close look at it to see just what it means for them and for their members.
Stephanie Furtado is in studio with me as well. She's in the School of Labor and Employment Relations at the University of Illinois. Stephanie, that confusion aside, what do you think is going on here?
I mean, I think it's really alarming, right? There were 200 faculty. There's 200 less faculty because of the budget impasse, right, at SIU. And so although they're saying that this is not anything too unusual, what they're proposing are like three-year relationships with 0%, zero pay alumni to do roles that should be being done by faculty, right, that are being paid. And it's part of a really alarming trend. You know, the research arm of the labor education program, the Project for Middle Class Renewal, did a report last year about jobs in higher education and in public education in Illinois. And there are 123,900 jobs that are related to higher education in Illinois. And what has happened with this recent budget impasse is that that really important part of our economy has shrunk in our state, and that's significant. On the same day, on April 6th, the News Gazette here did a story about how Texas public higher universities are trying to recruit some of our top professors to go to Texas, some of our leading research professors. On that very, very same day, the Chicago Tribune did a story about how the University of Alabama system is trying to recruit some of our best and brightest young people to attend their university instead of our university. And so as these conversations happen and are percolating up to the press, right, and not just the local press, but the national press about the situation at the University of Illinois, what's happening is we're losing some of our best faculty. We're losing some of our best students who want to work with some of our best faculty.
And let me just ask you one final question then, Stephanie, to you, to the point of you've talked about the job side, the economic impact of that, the student side. What, to your mind, is at stake here when we're wrapping all of this into this? Because it really does all come back to money and funding.
Right. So the Project of Middle Class Renewal, that report that we did, that we put out, showed that the budget impasse in higher ed cost the state $1 billion. In revenue, in earnings, right? As people left, and you know, some of these are decent paying jobs that are really important to our community. So you know, you lose that tax base, you lose those people spending money in their communities, and you know, you lose really powerful research that's really important to happen. Universities, higher education is one of the key economic drivers of any state. And so the state legislature needs to continue to work to fix this problem because our state will not be as strong in a lot of ways without the robust and really world-class university system that we have now.
That's Stephanie Furtado. She's a lecturer in the School of Labor and Employment Relations at the University of Illinois. I want to thank Jennifer Fuller as well, joining us from WSIU in Carbondale, Emily Boyer at Tri-States Public Radio in Macomb. Ladies, thank you all for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm loving it.
You listen to what I have to say, man.
I'm loving it.
但他开心就好气氛，莫非都系想个世界多啲fun。I'm loving it. Did you catch the "I'm loving it" there from that's a 2003 Hong Kong McDonald's ad? I don't know if you understood that rap portion of it unless you speak Cantonese. But if you want a taste of McDonald's from Hong Kong or Australia or France, the ground floor of the company's new global headquarters in Chicago has you covered. It opened just yesterday in the West Loop. The new building cost $250 million. Louisa Chu ate all of the international food items on the menu, or at least the ones that are available right now. She's a reporter with the Chicago Tribune. She's host of the Chewing podcast, and she's on the line now from Chicago. Hi, Louisa. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you, Nyla. I was not loving it, and I do understand Cantonese, and I'm not sure that there was a correct translation at the new restaurant for the new international menu items.
Okay, we're going to get into that in a minute. Also on the line with us is Bridget Sweeney, a consumer reporter with Crain's Chicago Business. Hey, Bridget, thanks for being with us as well.
Hi, Nyla. Thank you.
We just have a few minutes left of the show, but we always want to hear from you all. If you want to tell us if you've been eating more or less fast food over the years, you can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21STShow. Louisa, let's go into your translation of that rap and also the line in this. This is the line you wrote in your critique for the Chicago Tribune, saying this is not so much an international menu as a international incident menu. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Well, it means that there was allegedly a salad that was attributed to France I was told that this matzah salad is one of the most popular food items in France. It is apparently their translation of an Italian salad with a shockingly, disturbingly mushy pasta, a few rubbery, flavorless mozzarella balls, and this balsamic simulation. And somehow France is being blamed for this Italian mozzarella salad. I think there might be potential for an international incident there.
I was going to say my only international McDonald's experience is actually from the UK, because that's the only foreign country I lived in where I actually did go to McDonald's. And the only notable exception to the menu, I feel like at least when I lived in London, was it when you order apple pie, it comes with ice cream and Cadbury chocolate flake. Bridget, how different are the menus across the world? Is this part of a long-time business strategy for McDonald's?
Absolutely. And I think kind of this is a huge generalization, but one of the hallmarks of, you know, American college students studying abroad is, you know, I remember going to McDonald's in other countries and being like, oh my gosh. That said, the international menu, which as Louisa mentioned, you know, is perhaps not as exciting or as overwhelming as some people may expect. It will only be available in this one location, as far as we know, in Chicago. Robert Gibbs, the chief communications officer, didn't really directly answer the question, but he said that this is kind of a special, unique place. So don't expect to see these McFlurries from Brazil and the burger from Canada coming to other locations.
Bridget, have you had a chance to eat the foods?
You know what? I was laughing because I was there for the preview, but I was typing so frantically trying to meet my deadline that I walked in with a Starbucks coffee, which is a huge faux pas, and then I
not even a McCafe, Bridget.
I know, which I do drink. So I drink McDonald's coffee sometimes. But anyway, the thing I was most intrigued by that I did not taste was the loaded fries, which are an Australian thing, and it's just the regular fries, but with cheese and bacon. So,
Louisa, go ahead. We want to hear what you thought about those loaded bacon fries from Australia.
I think they might have been unloaded or offloaded somewhere, because they were just pretty much the classic McDonald's fries with a warm cheese sauce and bacon bits. And really, the thing that shocked me the most was that this was the really well-planned, well-thought-out media preview, and there was, quite frankly, barely any cheese or bacon on there, and I'm not really quite sure. Again, I think that it is a fascinating psychological thought experiment that this is an American restaurant that is serving food in Australia, and apparently this is the most favorite, one of the favorite items in Australia. So there's a twofold strategy, I was told, by also Robert Gibbs, as well as Anne Walgren, who is their global menu strategy VP, is that not only are these favorite items worldwide, but also what they thought worked well with a local audience, locals meaning West Loop and Chicago. And so, quite frankly, I am a big fast food fan and have visited McDonald's worldwide. I'm shocked that out of the many choices that are available, that these are the ones that they thought would make the biggest splash on an opening. There really was not there very much special about those items. That Mighty Angus Burger from Australia, we are now at a point where we're really lucky in Chicago and in the U.S. in general, in the Midwest especially, where we have really great regional burgers, and that was not much different than any other standard fast food burger.
What about the McSpicy from Hong Kong?
I'm not sure this lives up to the translation in our original song there, but that is a breaded, deep-fried, supposedly spicy. It did have a tiny bit of heat, fried sandwich. And what was interesting is that the official press release said that it was breast meat, which, as we may know, all white breast meat has been a big selling point for a lot of fast foods here in the U.S., but it's actually made with thigh meat here in the U.S. as well as in Asia, which is something that I confirmed as well. But served on a regular plain hamburger bun with sad iceberg lettuce and a lot of mayonnaise. Again, maybe it's because the Hong Kong audience thinks this is what's popular in the U.S. and that's what made it most popular.
Or do you think, Louisa, we're almost out of time. Do you think something got lost in translation between an American chain going to bringing their international things back to the U.S.?
I do. I hope, and I hope menu changes every couple of months, so I think that we have some potential hope to bring that tikka masala wrap, which I heard Robert Gibbs say he really liked a lot.
I've heard a lot about that. I've never tried it, but all right. Well, if you're in downtown Chicago on the ground floor of the new $250 million building at the West Loop. Bridget Sweeney has been reporting on that for Crane Chicago Business. Louisa Chu giving us her food critique for the Chicago Tribune. And again, she's a fast food lover, so this is a harsh critique from Louisa. Ladies, thank you both for being with me. I appreciate it. That's all the time we have for today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Voodoo. Have a great day.